You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, November 4th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, no longer in the literal, never having been in the metaphorical shadow of the New York Times, nor are we in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, but instead in sunny downtown Brooklyn. I'm working on it, folks. Today on the program, of course, it is midterm election day. We'll also be talking to Esther Kaplan, writing in The Nation, Americans are working so hard, it's actually killing people. Also on the program today, a breakdown of referendums across the country, Senate races, state house races. The Patriot Act, turns out, is increasingly being used not for terrorism, but for drug investigations. Surprise, surprise. Goes my soundboard, which is not up. And also on the program today,
call me out and then just not
Bill
do
de Blasio
it.
Unveils a new plan for troubled schools. Keep voting, ladies and gentlemen. Keep voting. Will you turn up my earphones a little bit?
Oh, sure. Should I turn your soundboard down?
No, that's fine. All that and more on today's program. Folks, just a reminder, we are still getting settled into the new office. We've got a lot of work to do in terms of helping out the sound quality and tech stuff, but we wanted to be sure that we were on air for the days leading up to the midterm elections and the day following the midterm election, although it's very possible we won't have a clear sense as to who controls the Senate by tomorrow's program. It's quite possible we may not know for a couple of months. And if that's the case, then Democrats have done better than predicted. At this point, it looks like, it's very tough to say, but it's quite possible that even by tomorrow, with two races extant, that being Georgia and Louisiana, which could go to runoffs, Democrats would have already lost control of the Senate. But again, very important for you to go out and vote regardless of what state you're in. A lot of important governor races in Maine. 20 inches of snow in northern Maine, a foot in Bangor. That's going to hurt Michaud's chances, arguably. You've got the independent Cutler going around still campaigning, even though he has basically said he's sort of endorsing his Democratic rival. Cutler has no chance of winning. He does have a chance of making sure that Governor LePage wins and therefore still preventing tens of thousands of Mainers the opportunity to get health care via Medicaid. That dynamic is going on across the country. We will get to that and more as the program continues. But we talked about Charlie Pierce's exchange with Joni Ernst yesterday, but he updated his piece. He writes, I neglected to include Ernst's rather epic answer to a follow-up question from Ben Terrace of the Washington Post, who wanted to know how the president could be apathetic and at the same time be dictatorial. Her answer is as follows. Quote, that's where he is a leader. So many of the actions that he proposes taken are actions that should be done by Congress, not by the president. He is our executive. He is our leader. He is our president. Congress should be making the legislative actions. Charlie Pierce adds in response to Ernst's earlier comments that it was just his opinion that only one person in the country had Ebola. He writes, this is a fact. There is one person in America with Ebola. This is my opinion. There is one more person in America with Ebola than there are people who understand what in the name of John C. Calhoun's eyebrows she's talking about here. The great Charlie Pierce writing in Esquire. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Esther Kaplan on her piece, Americans Are Working So Hard, It's Actually Killing People. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone, the editor of the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. On her piece, Americans Are Working So Hard, It's Actually Killing People, Esther Kaplan. And we should note that your piece was reported with the support of a fellowship from the Alicia Patterson Foundation and appears, of course, in the upcoming numbers, November 17th. Issue of The Nation magazine. Esther Kaplan, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Sam. It's a great show.
Thank you, Esther. That's nice. Now, your piece is also a great piece and really disturbing in, well, just about every respect. And I have to say, it really resonated with me. My mother-in-law is a nurse, and for the sake of her maintaining her job, I'm not going to say where, but she has been talking about this dynamic for the past couple of years, and it's been sort of stunning to watch and disturbing to know that it's one that is widely, I guess, experienced. Tell us about Jessica Wheeler and Wilkes-Barre General Hospital in Pennsylvania.
Well, what's happening there is probably one on the extreme end of things, but it's happening in hospitals all around the country because the nonprofit and public hospitals are being squeezed by budget cuts. But this hospital, Wilkes-Barre General, out in northeastern Pennsylvania, kind of former coal mining country, like hundreds of hospitals across the country, was snapped up by a big national for-profit chain, Community Health Systems, now the biggest chain in the United States. Many, many hospitals are now owned by for-profit corporations. Just a generation ago, this was not true at all. It's a massive shift in what's going on, and they're bringing this corporate cost-cutting agenda. So I talked with nurses there and at other CHS-owned hospitals, and everywhere you see this pattern where nurses leave their jobs and they don't fill the vacancies, and it results in staff cuts of 10% or more and just completely untenable patient loads that are creating extreme risks for the patients at the hospital and also for the nurses. I mean, emotionally, these are nurses that have to pop Xanax and antidepressants and sleeping pills just to make it through their work week. and nurses who are going through brutal surgeries because they have to turn obese patients without the proper staffing. It's not a pretty picture.
What is it about that has happened in the past 10 years that has created, I mean, and I want to get into some of the sort of the broader issues you talk about in the piece in terms of rising productivity for workers. And we talk about that quite a bit on this program, but we'll talk about what it actually means on the ground. But before we get there, but in particular in the in the sort of the medical industry, like what has been the dynamic that has created this concentration? Is it simply, is there something specific that is going on within the medical field or the hospital business that is creating this type of concentration?
Well, I think it's a lot like what we're seeing happening in the public schools, where corporations are seeing a big pot of money and thinking, let's go into this sector that has been previously controlled by nonprofits and government entities. And generally what CHS, the chain in this case, does, their model is to go into smaller towns or rural areas where there's no competition. They buy a hospital. They don't go into places like New York City or Philadelphia with lots and lots of hospitals competing for patients. They go where it's the only hospital serving an area or one of two. They buy it. They jack up the prices. Some of their hospitals are among the most expensive on a procedure by procedure basis in the entire country. And then they slash the staff. And, you know, they're just taking an opportunity to turn what is really a public good, healthcare, and turn it into a profit center.
So let's take a moment and speculate as to what's how they approach this. So in other words, I mean, they basically just say, like, we can go in, we can cut back on the service, we undoubtedly have streamlined procedures so that we can get the cost down, and we can just cut back on the service because we have there's no competition. The bar to entry in terms of somebody coming in and starting a new hospital is so high that it's never going to happen, and we can get away with this. What about, is there any, like, is there been any sort of legal pushback? I'm talking more like civil pushback, because if I was to read your piece and I was a trial attorney, the first thing I would do would be to contact some of these nurses to see if I could find out who their patients were, and I would sue these companies. I mean,
Well, they've been the subject of a lot of lawsuits, both from labor unions over health treatment and also patients. They've also recently just settled with federal attorneys over a massive scheme to overbill on Medicaid, I think it was, or Medicare. $98 million settlement just a couple months back. So they are scofflaws, CHS.
But I mean, are they subject to any, like, I mean, is anybody going in there and saying, you know, malpractice? I mean, somebody has passed away, or somebody's not getting the treatment that they need in this situation. Have there been a lot of any type of litigation in that way?
Well, there certainly have been malpractice suits. I did not look into whether it's higher than with other hospitals. I mean, obviously, all hospitals carry massive amounts of malpractice insurance because that is a danger for them if they do get sued. There are sometimes, even at the best of hospitals, there are poor health outcomes, and people will try to find a bad guy in that scenario. Clearly, in my view, they're making strategic decisions about staffing that are putting their patients at risk.
All right, so let's move on to, like, sort of the broader dynamic that's here, because this isn't just confined. I mean, A, this isn't just confined to the medical profession, and
right.
B, it's not just a question of people dying, really, at the end of the day. I mean, it's when we talk worker productivity, We talk about it usually in terms of it outpacing wages, but it really has to do with the fact that corporations are just taking profits, and we're subsidizing corporate profits, and people are. It's sort of amazing that in this day and age, we're working that much more than we did 10, 15, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. And getting nothing for it, but even having to do that.
Well, I mean, that's the irony of this current economic landscape. I think some of us are out of work, and some of us have been out of work for a very long time, and some of us can only get part-time work, you know, people at Starbucks and McDonald's and so on who are just scrambling to even get 18 hours a week, 20 hours of work a week, and then other people are being worked to the breaking point. I mean, to the absolute breaking point, because there hasn't, I mean, part of this doldrums in terms of hiring is the people who do have jobs in many industries are just being worked until their bodies are literally broken. And I talked to folks in a lot of different industries that didn't even show up in the piece, like hotel workers, you know. They have the same number of rooms that they're supposed to do per shift as they did 20 years ago, before it was king-size beds and 8 pillows and 3 layers of duvets. And the injury rate among hotel housekeepers now outstrips the people working in the commercial kitchens. Mm. And they're getting trauma injuries from slipping and falling, and they're tearing their shoulders out trying to change sheets so rapidly. I mean, everywhere you look, I looked at meat packers in the piece. I mean, it's just the incredible stress on people's bodies. We look at productivity as a great thing. That's America. We're more productive than other nations. Our GDP grows and we're more productive, and it's, you know, hooray and hurrah, but it's really good for corporate bottom lines, and workers are being pushed to the absolute limits. I mean, it was amazing how many different industries I spoke with people where they have to pop Tylenol to get through work each day. I mean, that is a sign that your body can't take what it's the workload that's being dumped on you.
The stuff about the meat processing workers was incredible. Let me just read a little bit of these statistics. You were talking to Juan Martinez, who worked, at a Cargill beef processing plant near Omaha. His crew had to slice up. I mean, it's disgusting and it's disturbing. His crew had to slice up 4,600 20 to 30 pound pieces per shift. In the 4 years he was at the plant, from 03 to 06, the number of people at his station dropped from 8 to 6 or 7, while the parts kept coming. So in other words, you've lost something like 15% of your workforce. Or you can look at it as your work, the amount of work that you had to do rose by 15%
to 25%.
Yeah. Another meatpacking worker, when he started, he says they killed 1,000 cattle in a 10-hour shift. Now they kill 1,100 in 8.5 hours. You found line speeds in meatpacking and poultry. They're going faster, and they're trying to raise the caps on this. And you talk about this dynamic taking place across a whole raft of industries. But let's talk about this notion of how we are sold this idea that a continuous increase in productivity is somehow something that we want. Aside from the fact that workers are not getting the benefits of it, maybe there is some type of theoretical value to it. But what is it, supposedly, is the theoretical value?
Well, you read any kind of intro to econ textbook, and it tells you that the only way we're going to get a better standard of living and increase our prosperity is by increasing productivity. This is how it's done. But as you know, you've covered on your show, that model is broken. The idea was that the gains from that increased prosperity would be shared with the workforce, and it's not. So now, whereas once upon a time, workers might have been, okay, I'll work harder if I get a raise, you know, maybe that's worthwhile. Maybe it's worth, you know, risking breaking my back or carpal tunnel syndrome in my hands because I'm getting paid, I'm supporting my family. That's not even true anymore. You know, I talked to one labor economist who said, you know, there's such a gap between the increased productivity and increased pay at this point that you can't even really say workers are consenting to this. This is overwork being imposed from above, and there's absolutely no benefit that's trickling down to the workers. And yeah, I mean, I feel like we need to start questioning this gospel that productivity, increases in productivity are always good. Good for who?
And the way that they're getting to workers, I mean, I think you you quoted a 2010 survey from Monster.com. Now, that's now we're nearly 4 or 5 years out from that, but there's no real reason to believe this dynamic has changed anyway. But that 53% of respondents had taken on additional duties since the start of the recession because coworkers had been laid off. You know, intuitively anyways, it would appear that the reason why one does this is essentially blackmail, right? Because you'll be out on the street as well.
Yep, and that's the dynamic. I mean, we have shrinking labor union presence in the private sector. We have this very slack labor market. So employers have enormous leverage, and this is how they're using it, to squeeze the last drop of sweat out of everyone on their payroll.
Is this sort of dynamic, do you think it's permeating any of the sort of the national consciousness? I mean, the only time I see this disparity between productivity and wages, for instance, which is also the only time that we see any scrutiny on the increase of productivity is in the context of the minimum wage fight.
Right.
It doesn't seem to... Nobody seems to sort of question the rise in productivity and the disparity in wages across the board in any other context. And nobody then seems to question just the notion of, like, you know, we've dropped the important assumption in the desire for increased productivity.
Well, I think this is one of the problems in our national debate is all the stress that people are experiencing on the job. We personalize it. You know, we have a giant literature, if you want to call it that, of, you know, struggling with work-life balance and all this stuff, you know, as if it's just my problem or your problem that, oh, wow, I'm really having trouble dealing with the pressures of my job and my family, when this has to do with these big trends in corporate America, unpredictable scheduling, mandatory overtime. I mean, all these things that are pushing people beyond the limits where they can actually manage their lives. And yet we talk about it as if this is, you know, just, you know, mom engaged in her juggling act of trying to be, you know, a worker and a mother. And we don't look at the structural problems that are at play, and we need to.
It's interesting because that's the same dynamic we saw. We talked about a piece the other day about the end of retirement. And mm-hmm. when I talk to people who gone across the country and talk to people who are dealing with foreclosure, same exact dynamic, right? I mean, it's all mm-hmm. I've made some bad choices in my life.
Exactly.
I failed to do certain things, as opposed to seeing the sort of a greater systemic dynamics that are at work here. Esther Kaplan, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it. Hopefully we'll hear more about this notion of, and it really is sort of like just a religion now, isn't it? That increased productivity will bring us that manna from heaven, even when it doesn't.
Yeah, well, I think that people's lived reality is going to start making them ask these questions.
Let's hope so, and let's hope that they tie that in to broader systemic problems rather than just, man, I shouldn't have been a nurse or something, I guess.
Right.
Esther Kaplan, the piece is Americans Are Working So Hard It's Actually Killing People. It'll be in Nation's November 17th edition. Thanks so much for coming on and talking about it.
And I should say it is online now.
It is, and we will put a link to it at majority.fm. Esther Kaplan,
all right, thanks
so much.
Sam.
All right, folks. Let's talk a little bit about the midterms. I'll be on Twitter tonight, I think, starting, I don't know, probably right after Mila goes to sleep, or maybe before she does. Maybe I'll let her watch MSNBC with me tonight, if that's where I'm watching. But just to give you a sense of that's what basically what dictates what I do in the evening, basically what my daughter will allow me to do on any given night. We're going to get to that Lena Dunham thing, because every time I think about my my daughter now, this comes up. It's just ridiculous. Why are you giving me that look, Matt? Just because you're exasperated by the whole thing?
Yes.
What?
No, I'm just...
Well, you think we're inviting? Like,
yeah, let's just leave it be and just move on.
No, it's just I find it just stunning. I mean, aside from the disingenuousness coming from the right, but the ignorance from, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to paint with broad generalizations. I think too often people sort of make these broad generalizations based upon some very vocal Twitter accounts.
I agree. But, so we should go to the better half, think it over a bit, and then decide not to do it.
I'm not. Why? I don't care, honestly. Honestly, I don't care. Anybody wants to send me emails or tweet at me a lot from Gamergate or from Lena Dunhamgate, be my guest. I honestly could not give a crap. But we do have bigger fish to fry at the moment, I guess. A couple of things you should know. Let me give you just a breakdown of how the timing is going to go tonight. At 7 p.m., we will see the first results coming in from Kentucky. And I'm only going to be talking about the states that are relevant here in terms of the Senate and maybe some key gubernatorial races. Everyone should be going out to vote. I don't care what state you're in. Go out and vote. Surely there's a referendum that's relevant. 7 p.m., we will hear from Kentucky. Again, odds are McConnell's going to win, but Cliff Schechter's got a lot on the line on this one. The race has definitely moved in the wrong direction for him over in the closing days, but we shall see. And then also at 7 p.m., we'll start to get some Georgia results. The real question there will be not just who's going to win in the popular vote, but will one of either Perdue or none get over 50% and avoid a runoff? My guess is no, regardless of who wins. So that could be a race that's not decided for, gosh, at least a month. At 7:30, you'll see results coming in from North Carolina. Kay Hagan, odds-on favorite to win this one. Not in the least because of the Moral Monday organizing that has gone on there. I mean, there has been intense preparation to deal with things like the voter ID in North Carolina and all of the restrictions that the North Carolina legislature placed on elections. And you'll recall that Tom Tillis was the Speaker of the House when they ran through a lot of this stuff. In fact, let's just to remind you of who Tom Tillis is. When these results come in at 7:30 tonight in North Carolina, let's just go back to 2011. He was then the Speaker of the North Carolina House. He was at a town hall meeting talking about how Republicans, what they need to do in terms of the poor. Is it we should help the poor? We should love those people who are struggling in the wake of the financial crisis like we would love a member of our family? No, not exactly.
But what we have to do is find a way to divide and conquer the people who are on assistance. We have to show respect for that woman who has cerebral palsy and had no choice in her condition that needs help and that we should help. And we need to get those folks to look down at these people who choose to get into a condition that makes them dependent on the government and say, at some point, you're on your own. We may end up taking care of those babies, but we're not going to take care of you. And we've got to start having that serious discussion. It won't happen next year. Wrong time, because it's going to be politically charged. One of the reasons why I may never run for another elected office is because some of these things may just get me railroaded out of town. But in 2013, I honestly believe that we have to do this.
There you go. In 2013, well, it's 2014. So remember, the key to Republican governance, find people who are afflicted with a disease, empower them to look down upon people who have lost their job or who have whose jobs have been outsourced or have had bad luck or have gone into bankruptcy because of medical bills or have taken time to take care of their family. That's what you need to do. You need to empower those people with a disease to look down and attack people who are down on their luck.
Could you even just imagine how that would sound? Like, y'all really don't need this, but I do. I do. I need it.
Can you give him a shofar? That's the best impression he's ever
done.
There
you
go. Child don't understand is that I'm a genuine pickle. You're nothing.
That's right.
I hate you so much. Here's my government subsidized medication. I'm going to need that to keep my strength up to badmouth you and demean you in your life circumstance.
But that is,
y'all are pathetic.
I mean, contemplate, that is the ultimate Republican sort of, I guess, dynamic, right? This is Mitt Romney complaining that he's not going to win because, 47% out there are takers. This is Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat, but again, of this same mentality. The reason why I have difficulty in politics is because my dad was a famous politician. I mean, it's just stunning.
So take another scenario. I have no family connections, no name recognition whatsoever. I would probably at the least be Senate Majority Leader. But I got a dad who's a freaking governor. Everybody knows him. It's okay. I do okay. I'm governor of New York. All right. No problem. Take away that last name, family connections, open doors to everything in politics. Sky's the limit, my friend.
President of the United States may be in charge of the One World Order. 8 p.m. tonight, New Hampshire will come in. That is when we will have to say, wait till next year for Scotty B.
Where do you think he'll go next?
I'll see you in Maine, suckers.
Maine. Yo.
Dude. I'm not going to go to Vermont because it's weird, but everything else is sort of.
Why wouldn't I go to Rhode Island?
See you in Rhode Island, suckers.
Yo. I'm going to go down to Pawtucket. I'm going to catch some Sox games, some minor league ones. I like they got the sweet-ass, what is it called? Blackstone Canal in Providence.
Place is wicked awesome.
So sweet. So sweet.
Without joking, do we seriously think that he's going to go to another state and try again?
I'd like to announce now that based upon my experience in dealing with kings and queens, I will be moving to London, England to run for Prime Minister.
Cheerio, chap. Look.
Toodaloos.
You know what he's, I bet what he's really upset about is there's a the governor's race in Massachusetts is not looking so great. And you have a guy.
I could have taken Baker. I could have taken Martha Coakley.
Again.
How many times do I have to beat her?
Yeah. Martha, like, get a message or whatever. Like, go, you know, retire. But Charlie Baker is like a Mitt Romney type guy who's pretending to be like Scott Brown and winning.
Right.
So he must be really, I mean, to the extent of which he even thinks.
I just
want to
say, you know, Martha Coakley, 0 for 2. At least I was 1 for 3. At least I won one. Florida will also, polls will close at 8 p.m. Going to be a very tight race with Crist and Skeletor. I can't even remember. Rick Scott. And what hangs in the balance here is really hundreds of thousands of people who will be eligible for Medicaid if Charlie Crist becomes governor. Who could very well be eligible for Medicaid.
And I would, the other thing.
Same with Paul LePage in Maine, particularly in Maine at 8 p.m. tonight. So
don't you think the other thing to add about Charlie Crist, and I know that he's like a questionable candidate in a lot of ways, but when he was a Republican, he actually did, like, he wasn't a late converter on voting rights.
That's
he
right.
actually did good things
right.
as a Republican
That's
governor
right.
of Florida. And for that alone, I think he's, you know, he's worthy of a lot of appreciation, and certainly a vote in Florida.
Yep. 8:30 p.m., Arkansas. This is going to be odds on that Pryor will lose his seat to Tom Cotton. Just the bat crap crazy caucus of the Republican Party is going to grow, ladies and gentlemen, in the Senate. And it is, I think it's going to be really ugly. I mean, I see pieces where people are talking about just the Supreme Court justices. That's really the only thing that's here. And again, I really think there is a great overestimation as to President Obama's willingness to be in conflict with a Republican-controlled Senate and House. I just think that this is not a guy, and I hope I'm wrong, but I just do not get the sense that he is going to want, after these 2 years, to be his legacy, to be 125 vetoes. I just don't think that's the case. Also at 9 p.m. Eastern, all these times obviously are Eastern because we're in the East, and that's from whence I talk. You've got Kansas. Pat Roberts could very well lose to independent Orman. Orman may end up caucusing with the Republicans if the Republicans take the advantage in the Senate. Colorado also at that time. I know all the pundits are saying Udall's going to lose. I think there's a chance here that he wins. Just because for some reason Colorado, they do not seem able to figure out who is going to come out and vote. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker apparently has begun to open up a little bit of a lead over Mary Burke. Hopefully that's not the case. Again, it's going to be about turnout. They have succeeded, I think, in trying to suppress the vote in Wisconsin. Well, it's a question as to whether or not this is going to drive more people to the polls. I guess we'll find out. New York State, Michigan also at 9 p.m. 10 p.m., we have the Iowa Senate seat. This could be the real crucial seat anyways in terms of tomorrow. In other words, if the Democrats lose Iowa, if Bruce Braley loses to Joni Ernst, chances are that by tomorrow the Republicans will have a 51-47 edge in the Senate with the races in Louisiana and Georgia extant. In other words, they're going to have to go to runoffs. At midnight, we will hear from Alaska as well. And my guess is that I still think Begich is gonna pull it out there. Very uphill battle, but you'll recall that he ran against Stevens in 2010. And I think Stevens was under indictment at that time, and he still barely eked it by. But this is another place where the Democrats have really concentrated on the get out the vote, and we shall see. We shall see. You should know about this election before we go into the funner half, where we will talk about Ben Stein, just because we have to. I will talk about that Lena Dunham thing. This Wisconsin congressional candidate Glenn Grotham, who I don't know why he would feel it necessary to defend the Uganda's Kill the Gays bill, but who knows what the dynamics are in Wisconsin, I guess. But $4 billion. $4 billion. Is the amount that will be spent on this midterm election. It breaks all records of spending in midterm elections. Some enormous amount of, listen to this, outside groups have aired more than 1.5 million television campaign ads. And we should say that all of this reporting that I'm talking about now does not include the last 2 weeks, where apparently these outside groups are spending at an even increasing rate because they don't have to report it until after the election. We're talking millions of campaign ads. So when you wonder why mainstream media does not report on the problems, the corrupting influences of money in politics, it is because it is one of their primary sources of revenue. I mean, just imagine in the context of this show, if I had two donors, one donor, who was not only funding the show, but funding, I don't know, the repeal of the minimum wage. There would be some hesitancy on my part to talk about it. That's why I won't do that. That's a bit of an extreme example. It's hard to imagine that person, all the other issues would align with what we talk about on this program, but that's the dynamic that's going on there. They're not going to report on it. They're not going to hammer away at it because it is one of their number one sources of revenue. So you got $4 billion with a B spent in these midterm elections. However, it is one of... That $4 billion has bought one of the most unenthused electorate for a midterm election in recent memory. NBC Wall Street Journal poll found that 58% of Republicans in late October said they were interested in the campaign, statistically identical to the 57% of Democrats. At the same time, in the advance of the Republican wave in 2010, 70% were interested. In 06, before the Democratic wave, two-thirds of Democrats professed interest, well above today's level. So we have a record number of money being spent, an inordinate lack of interest, and I would imagine we're going to have results that will benefit big money.
Surprise, surprise.
Folks, it is your support that keeps this program alive. I don't want to take that money from that guy who wants to repeal the minimum wage. Although, let me just share a libertarian perspective on that. We all know what happened to the elevator operators. And we all know what happens when you play a game of chess. Let me just leave it there. Hey, hey, hey. So if you don't want to hear more libertarian nonsense, and I do mean nonsense, from me anyways, by all means, become a member today. You can join the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com or just simply going to majority.fm, click on Become a Member. It is your support that makes this program possible. Also, justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. Number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Please vote, folks. Please vote. Take your IMs at Majority FM or via the app, which you can pick up at Majority App. We'll be right back after this.